CliffCentral.com.
Cliff Central.
The revolution.
I've got something important to tell you.
CliffCentral.com.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the second part of the Help review, the Help the movie.
Hello. Sorry, I just feel like she always greets you, and she never greets me. And I make it a point to greet her all the time.
That's definitely
a
thing.
No, she just greets you, and then she
freak out. I freak out, and then I get really serious.
She cuts straight to the point, and then I have to say hi later on, like question two.
Okay, let me start with you then. Hi, Em. How are you?
Yo, I'm good. Stop wasting time, Lisa. Get out of this.
Really?
Get out
great.
Of this.
Okay. So, everyone, we hope you enjoyed the first part. The second part will just be a continuation. So we just want to remind you of the characters. There was the main one, Skeeter, who was the young white female journalist that was very interested in a space that she otherwise wasn't allowed to be in. There was Abilene and Minnie, who were the two main maid characters. And then there was Hilly, who was the very mean, very two-faced white woman. Sort of the villain in the story, and Celia, who was the woman that was, you know, sort of the outcast, as also a young white woman, but the outcast in the group of white women.
And Elizabeth.
And Elizabeth. Had the baby. Yes, Elizabeth, who had the baby.
She didn't like.
She was going through post-traumatic stress.
Oh, you were going to justify it.
Yes.
Scientific.
But that's a real thing.
She just didn't like that kid.
A real thing,
she thought
girl.
The kid was ugly. She didn't like the
because
kid.
Of the PTSD. Guys.
She's a mean person. She's a horrible person.
all their different maids in between.
So, I mean, watching this movie, I can't tell you. Like, I watched it when it came out, but having gone through this process, I cannot tell you
how much more you pick up,
how much more I'm seeing, you know, and how much more it's impacted me, right? And it's just like it's having the experience, but also the perspectives from such a on such a intimate level. You know what I mean? Just it's just different being part of something.
Yeah, completely. And yet I also feel like I'm bumping my head because it also just reminds me how difficult the space is.
Yeah, but also how nothing's changed, right?
Yeah.
Like we're following a similar process.
Yeah.
In the sense that we started off similarly, we wanted to do a book, but also I think we're having a lot of the same challenges that Skeeter did, which is amazing. But
then do you think, I mean, if we can see that through all these years, a lot of things hasn't changed, do you still believe that we will make significant changes, the changes we have in mind?
Yeah, but I think, you know, we've got the benefit, and this is why it's valuable to watch a movie like this and to be able to learn from history and to say, okay, you know, because everything can seem novel.
Completely.
If you don't have a historical context of anything, it could seem novel. And if something seems novel, then you don't know, like, you don't know how to navigate it. Do you know what I mean? Because you feel like it's happening for the first time. But I think the fact that we can compare and contrast our experience and the experience in this movie, even though it's in Mississippi, America, you know, the mere fact that on a human level we can do that comparison means that we know what is likely to change and we know what is likely to stay the same and why. It's just like, I think it's easy to navigate, you know, when you can compare.
And it's also nice to know all the factors that actually keep it the same. They could pinpoint what their setbacks would be and we can pinpoint ours today.
Yeah.
Even though they look different, but
I think it's harder for us
same,
from an advocacy point of view, because it was easier then just to outlaw things that were unjust. It was easier and it's almost like it's harder after the fact, you know. It's harder after the civil rights movement to then have to address people's mindsets because those things are so entrenched, right? Here and as any kind of an activist or interventionist in a social space, you want to be able to do things that are tangible, right? You want to be able to make measurable progress. The easiest way to do that is institutional. So if there are laws standing in your way, do you know what I mean? Or policies, then you know exactly what the enemy is, right? And it's like easier to measure your impact and to have an impact. But what we're living in an ideal democracy, quote unquote, from an institutional perspective. So much of what we have to do is about socialization.
Yeah.
Which makes it so much harder.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, I mean, the likes of Steve Biko did really understand that was necessary after, you know, political freedom and having rights. But, you know, who's ever taken that on as a national project, you know?
Yeah.
Whether here, whether in America, like, you know, things like Black Lives Matter happen after trauma, after, you know, devastating numbers of dead bodies. Mm. It doesn't happen before the fact. So, you know, who takes that on as a national challenge?
You and I. No, that's a good point. I mean, I don't know. It's just,
I mean, who even has the capacity to be believed that is an important thing to take on once freedom on paper is given? Because then everyone becomes about the hustle. Fine, I finally have the freedom to pursue a good career, the freedom to pursue true love, the freedom to pursue whatever.
It's incredibly sad how it always takes devastating consequences.
Mm.
Or more often than not, people aren't able to do things preventively. We're not that kind of, we're not that sophisticated as a human race, right? We've first got to crash and burn a little bit. And I mean, even in the movie, you know, if you think about how at first she was struggling to get maids on board and she only had Minnie and Abilene. And then once the killing happens, once the black boy is shot by the KKK, then everybody turns up.
But I'm just wondering, would a revolution be taken seriously if there wasn't devastation?
A preventive revolution.
yeah, but really, I'm wondering, would it be taken seriously if there isn't a visible or active threat? I mean, there's always an active threat, but if there wasn't a clearly visible threat, would it be taken seriously?
I think it would be really, really hard. Unfortunately,
I think so too.
I think then you don't call it a revolution. You might call it a renaissance of sorts. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or an, I don't know, like a conscientization, but nobody would call it a revolution, right?
Mm.
And that yeah.
Yeah, that's true. So revolutions are always responsive.
Yeah, but they also have much higher impact than a conscientization or a renaissance, you know?
Mm.
And if a revolution is the kind of systemic intervention or a systemic thing that needs to happen in the space, right? It has to be... It has to be, I mean, the change that needs to happen is revolutionary. But unfortunately, because, you know, so much of the shit within domestic work is dormant and it's been normalized and it's everything happens in secret. And I don't think that revolutions happen when there's a stalemate. There's just too much in the status quo of what this thing is.
Yeah.
Too much value for people.
But we'll find it.
It's fine. We'll figure it out. Okay, so speaking of things that haven't changed, that uniform is exact. I mean,
it really
give
is.
Or take like an apron.
I feel like
it's pretty much the same.
I feel like we could even see the like the texture, the material. The same.
It's still that same overall. It's still...
Yeah.
How... That is mind-blowing.
What I find interesting, though, because, you know, there were certain parts in the movie where they were acting as hosts, right? So, you know, the white ladies were having these tea parties or, I don't know, playing games and stuff, and the maids were hosting, but it gave them a somewhat formal look, right? You know, having that collar and having, you know, there was a professionalism to it. So
formal,
not
just, mechanized.
So not just, yeah, mechanized, certainly, yeah. but not just you know, so it wasn't just for practical reasons that I think that domestic worker outfit became what it was. I think it also had to do with showing some sort of respect to the person above you.
That's interesting. And speaking of that, I think it's a great segue because I mean, what really struck me in this movie, which I think still applies in our communities today, but not as much, is just how important social status and currency was above everything else. It was almost like a TV game. You know what I mean? It was almost like everyone knew they were playing chess and nothing was real in the interactions between these women, and I mean the madams and their husbands and their friends, you know?
Well, at the same time, that was the only thing that was real to them. Even though it wasn't real, that was also the only thing that was real.
Yeah, but it was so incredibly scary, and I don't think inaccurate at all. I mean, if I think even about my mom's history, you know, my mom grew up in rural South Africa during apartheid, right? And she was, well, previously disadvantaged.
Mm.
But even during her time, if I think about, you know, she tells me stories about her family and how she was raised and the pecking order and how, you know, important appearances were, and the competition between siblings and between peers and relatives and whatnot, and the values that her parents instilled and the discipline, and it's similar. It's like social order was everything.
But social order is also necessary because it's part of our survival. You know, because as humans, we can't live outside of groups.
Yeah.
So,
but for it to be so clinical, systematic,
yeah,
the way that it's done.
But then that's also how they make sure that they survive, you know?
It's true, but it's just, for me, the way it was explicit. One of the scenes that really struck me was when Abilene is talking to Skeeter about Elizabeth, who's her employer, and how, and Elizabeth, yes, Elizabeth's the mean woman who doesn't like her kid,
right? Post-traumatic stress disorder.
She's just a meanie.
She's not just mean, she's sick. She is sick.
Yeah, okay. That's one way to put it. We'll call it that. She's sick. She's socially sick. Yes, a lot of people are. How insistent Abilene was that Skeeter document the fact that she didn't feel that her employer should still be having kids, because she felt like she'd done such an injustice to her daughter, and she felt like it was because she wasn't attractive. You know, the kid just didn't look, and this is a little kid, she's like 2 or 3, you know, who isn't like a little bit podgy when you're like 2 or 3, right? I mean, it's quite normal at that stage, you know. You can't it's just strange to judge a 2 or 3 year old for their physical appearance, because so much can change.
Do you think that pressure came from her husband or from her girlfriends?
I think it came mostly from her girlfriends and from the idea of what a perfect nuclear family looks like. You know?
The 2.5 kids.
Yeah. And for me, yeah, like I was saying, everything was aesthetic. They just had so much invested in the way that they looked, their appearance, their personal appearance, their houses, the way that even social interactions felt designed, you know? Like the when they'd host bridge at their houses, the way they dressed, the help, that whole Africa benefit they had. I'm sure they had absolutely no clue about anything going on this continent back then in Mississippi, but they, you know, were insistent on having this benefit for poor African children. I literally think it was called that. Like, there was absolutely no depth African. Or detail. It was just a benefit for Africa.
Because we need that,
which
you know?
Is amazing. But, you know, I remarked last time, sorry, love, I remarked last time that I felt like beyond just being exploitive, the role of domestic worker was very much linked to social status, right? And that was evident in the way that Celia was so happy when she hired her first maid.
Mm.
You know what I mean? She felt like it was a rite of passage. The same applies clearly to children as well.
Yeah.
You know, everything is social currency.
And actually what I found very interesting, I think there were about 2 moments where, maybe 3, where Elizabeth starts to realize that extremely strong bond between Abilene and her daughter, and also how necessary that relationship was. So like the one time when she was sitting on the toilet in Hilly's yard.
Yeah, it was hilarious.
And she smacked her daughter in public because she felt very embarrassed. But then she saw Abilene just take the child, you know, to the side and give her a hug and make her feel loved. You could see that there was an awareness that she knew Abilene was doing something that she just wasn't capable of doing.
Absolutely.
And even when Skeeter had pointed that out as well to, you know, when she sort of fat shamed her child, and Skeeter pointed out that she's just a child who's, you know, got as much an appetite as any other child. There was a pause. You know, she realized that actually what she did had some effect on the child. Mm. And then she just went about her social business, you know. Mm. So mm. it's almost like she grants herself some moment, just a few seconds, to realize the gravity of something, and then she steps back right on autopilot. Back in. Yeah, she yeah. steps right back into that role again.
No, and I think you're right about the awareness. The other thing I realized was, like, these weren't necessarily bad people.
Mm.
It was just the social order that system was so stifling to their own humanity and to their own agency and to, you know, actually developing their own personal values mm-hmm. and beliefs.
Mm.
But there were definitely moments for me where I could see something was happening and it wasn't right. It was almost like there was a when Healy's Hilly, his maid, was arrested for stealing that ring.
Mm.
It was a very harsh arrest. The police really manhandled her, and I actually think they hit her at some point.
Mm.
And everyone was horrified, right? So definitely the maids who were in the bus, who were coming out of the bus as she was. But you could even see the madams, like, trying to hide their kids.
Children, yeah.
You know, trying to cover their kids' faces, because there was an awareness of how wrong it was, you know. And that's just one moment. There are definitely moments in this movie where you can tell these are people and they have a conscience, but they're incredibly stuck. And this is where I think something like prejudice can even be social currency. Mm-hmm. And people can be pressured into prejudice. And I think that probably still happens to this day. Mm. Because you feel, and it's a defense mechanism, because you feel somehow insecure, compromised in a situation, or you seek validation from a group, then you adopt that group's ideologies and their prejudices, not because you necessarily mean them and you've thought about them and processed them as your own, but just because, just to protect your position in the tribe.
Well, I think at the same time where they are held responsible is when they know that it gives them an upper hand that someone else doesn't.
Yeah.
That it stifles or inhibits someone else's ability to function normally within society. I think when there is a very clear understanding that that is what it does every time you play into that, even if it's not your choice to be in the societal, you know,
funk.
Yeah. Construct. I think just the fact that you know that you have the upper hand because you get to take that position.
Mm.
I think that's still what makes it quite problematic. So I think there's definitely a limit to what you inherit.
Mm.
There's a time when you actually become responsible for perpetuating it, for continuing it, and for upholding it.
Mm.
So I think that's actually where our society is, you know, where it's gone past inheriting the mess that we made.
Yeah. But what I also realize is that in any group, there are leaders of the pack. So Hilly would have been a leader of the pack, right? And she sets the tone.
Yeah.
And so she's to blame in that sense. And for the most part, everyone else is just playing along, which is equally dangerous.
Although she also inherited it.
She also did.
Even though she sort of bossed everyone around, but she certainly inherited it as well.
And I remember you were saying earlier on, probably the most painful thing for the domestic workers is how they raise these kids, love these kids, and then these kids turn out just like their parents.
Yeah. And that's a thing that I think is very hard for me to grasp in general. You know, if someone has expressed incredible and undying love to you, and that's a hard bond to break, but how does it end up breaking, you know? And understand, I mean, the way I imagined it is if you have a white mother expressing love to her white child, and you also have a domestic worker or a maid expressing love to the white child, that they're getting love from both places.
Mm.
And because the child knows who their mother is, she might choose that love over the other love in terms of, hierarchizing love.
Mm.
And also in terms of who they take as a mentor, as a person to learn from, that kind of stuff. But, you know, in cases where the mothers are not that loving or, you know, where there isn't a split love, where there isn't, you know, split, you know, adult roles.
Mm.
How does that prejudice continue?
I feel like in that situation, I mean, Skeeter is exactly a case in point there, right? Mm. Where she didn't feel like she had a role model in her own mother.
Yeah.
And so she preferred her maid, first of all, made that express, secondly, but also then became an activist for her issues, right? And so she writes the book and it's very personal for her.
Mm.
So I think that can happen.
I mean, it would be such a beautiful thing if the whole young generation was there to actually help their parents understand how to better treat the people that they...
I know, that would be beautiful.
Yeah.
That would be beautiful. But unfortunately, we're not all the same. I think you'd get a Skeeter who wouldn't turn out like that as well.
Mm.
I think as much as she might still have love, and I think this is what happens a lot, is you try to manage... You accept what the social order is, okay, so my domestic worker is not allowed to... Well, she doesn't eat with us, and we don't visit her home, and, you know, she's not treated as equal publicly, but, you know, there's so many people who are then kind of on the side, you know, like... building homes for their domestic workers, paying for their kids' tuition.
Mm.
Yeah, it's kind of like this backdoor thing where it's almost similar to how most children would secretly hang out and still do secretly hang out in the servants' quarters and eat meals with the domestic workers, right?
Mm.
Yeah, I think for the most part, people try to separate appearances from their actual experience.
What it actually makes me realize now is that those prejudicial actions then might not necessarily be perceived as not loving her.
Mm.
Because it then the children might just think, well, this is just the way we treat her.
Mm.
But if he or she feels love for the maid, then she believes this is the way I love her.
Yeah.
But I do love her.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting. So it actually takes away the idea that this could be a bad way to treat someone.
Yeah. I think just, I always say, I think for the most part, people are missing it. You know what I'm saying?
Mm.
You know what I'm saying?
And Skeeter said it perfectly. You can just take a listen to the clip.
Miss Stan, you said in your letter to write about what disturbs me, particularly if it bothers no one else. And I understand that now.
Sorry.
Continue. I'd like to write something from the point of view of the help. These colored women raise white children, and in 20 years, those children become the boss. We love them, and they love us. But they can't even use the toilets in our houses. Don't you find that ironic, Miss Stan?
I'm listening.
Margaret Mitchell glorified the mammy figure.
Dedicates her whole life to a white family. But nobody ever asked mammy how she
felt about it.
So aside to this, never before heard.
Yes. Because nobody ever really talks about it down here.
It must be hard to be Skeeter because Skeeter, as much as she's an activist, really, there are parts of her that still want to fit in, right?
Mm.
So she's never, first of all, she's never confrontational, is she?
Never, yeah. And in so many moments that she had the opportunity to, she's very passive-aggressive.
Very passive-aggressive, does sneaky things like the toilet scene where she wrote in the... she manufactured a typo in the newsletter and everyone ended up dropping their toilets and not their coats off... in Healy's garden, which was obviously devastating for her because she like won garden of the year or something and now there's like toilet bowls. And I think it was like Negro toilet bowls. And then what makes that scene even worse for Elizabeth, like you're saying, when she spanked her daughter in public, is because then Elizabeth's little daughter goes and sits on a Negro toilet and pees in public. It was horrible. But anyway, all of this, everything is passive aggressive because even politeness is social currency.
Completely.
You know what I mean? How bitchy can you be whilst being polite? That's a thing that gets you social currency.
She was already a sore thumb in the group. And then on top of it, to have to be the person that's always pointing things out differently.
I know. It must be exhausting.
While at the same time, I wonder, Because this is sometimes what some allies say. So sometimes they'll say, well, if I leave the group, who's going to tell them this? You know, mm-hmm. So sometimes it's important for them to keep their role because they're influential enough to tell their group of friends that something isn't okay.
So that's exhausting.
Is that an acceptable way, or is that an acceptable reason to be passive aggressive, to always sort of somehow say what you mean? For the sake of having that group exposed to that way of thinking.
The number one diplomat. I also believe in compartmentalizing. I think that they can coexist in relationships, things that you love about people and things that you hate.
Mm.
You know? And I think sometimes it's healthy to compartmentalize. And I think relationships about growing in any case, and I don't think that any growing happens if you jump ship. So, you know, there is...
But sometimes.
No, I don't know.
The ship must be jumped.
No. But I do think you need those types of people if they can manage the situation and not completely compromise their values and not do anything wrong. Because she's never, you know, she was able to do that very well. She's able to compromise and to stay in the group without actually being complicit.
But what it always sounds like is that the one that thinks differently is always doing it on everyone else's terms.
Yeah, for sure. You know? Until she wrote the book.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean?
And then got a complete break.
It's true. Speaking of the complete break and how normal she wanted to be, I mean, she says, you know, a consistent theme is her trying to find love in the movie, a husband.
What was it? Was it her intention?
I felt
was it
like
everyone
it was.
Else's intention?
I don't know.
It was a mother's
I felt
pressure
like there was something in her that really wanted it to, you know, because she definitely was willing to draw certain lines. I mean, she definitely, it was behavior she was not willing to accept in that man from the start, and she was just willing to leave it, you know. Mm-hmm. And then kind of the relationship, as he began to, you know, redeem himself and to really make an effort, then she started to soften as well. But I think there was something in her that wanted it to work. I think she particularly liked when he acknowledged how intelligent and powerful she was, and how refreshing it was for him, and that he'd never met a woman like that. And furthermore, he encouraged her to write a book about something that she loved. So I think there was something genuine in her wanting to be with him, but unfortunately fucking falls apart in the end.
Well, I guess, yeah, she was maybe looking for someone that was well suited to her, not just a man.
Yeah.
Just one.
So,
of the
I mean,
guys.
Let's play a few clips between the two of them.
How it goes from beautiful to sour.
How it kind of falls
very
apart.
Quickly. Oh, it was really sour to really beautiful to really sour again.
Yeah, it's quite interesting.
One drink?
Just water, please.
Double old Kentucky straight, the water back. You've got two backs.
You sure you don't want to just make it the whole bottle in a straw? Honey, there's the lieutenant governor. Let's go say hi.
Sir.
Hi, how are you?
So, what do you do with your time? You work?
I write. But right now I'm working on a domestic maintenance column for the Jackson Journal.
You mean housekeeping? Jesus, I can't think of anything worse than reading a cleaning column, except for maybe writing one.
Well, I can. Working with a bunch of greasy, stinky men in the middle of the ocean.
So it sounds to me like a ploy to find a husband, become an expert in keeping house.
Well, aren't you a genius? You figured out my whole scheme.
Isn't that what all you girls from Ole Miss major in? Professional husband hunting.
Who is hungry? I'm sorry, but were you dropped on your head as an infant? Or were you just born stupid?
We gotta get dressed.
What's wrong?
Don't panic. There's a particularly tall and very handsome man named Stuart here for you.
Oh, God. Oh, Mother. You would not like him, trust me. He's a drunken asshole.
Love and hate are two horns on the same goat, Eugenia. And you need a goat. Put that on.
Look, I know it was a few weeks back, but I came to say I'm sorry for the way I act.
Who sent you, William or Hilly?
Neither. particularly, but I wanted to come, okay? I was rude, and I've been thinking about it a lot.
Well, I haven't. She needs to go.
God damn it. I told Hilly I wasn't ready to go out on any date, all right? I wasn't even close to ready. I was engaged last year. She ended it.
I'm sure she did.
It's not like that. I'm not always a jerk. Anyway, we've been dating since we were 15, and you know how it is.
Actually, I don't. I've never really dated anyone before.
Ever?
Ever.
All right, Well, that must be it then.
What?
You, Skeeter. I've never met a woman that's exactly what she's thinking.
Well, I got plenty to say.
Yeah, I'll bet you do. You make me laugh. Smile. Would you like to come out to dinner with me? We could talk. I could actually listen to you this time.
I can't think of anything worse.
Well, I understand, and I'm sorry. That's what I came here to say, and I said it.
Just give me a minute. Let me get my sweater.
I'm not a big fan of oysters, huh?
Oysters are a vehicle for crackers and ketchup.
Well, here's the new beginning.
You're disgusting.
Yeah, you've already made that pretty clear. And just so you know, the boys caught me reading your Miss Myrna column on the rig the other day.
Really? You read them?
All of them. Very informative, too. I had no idea the ground eggshells got grease out of clothes.
Well, I did my homework.
You're a good writer, Skeeter.
Thank you. I want to be a journalist. Or maybe a novelist. Or maybe both.
I like that. You're really smart. And pretty. What
you
see makes
you feel so good. Told me to write something good, something I believed
in. It's not what I believe in. Now, that joke you pulled with Hilly with the toilets, that's funny. Why would you do this to us? I don't even know why you care.
What?
Things are fine around here. Why go stir up trouble?
Trouble's already here, Stuart. I had to tell you this. You needed to know.
Goddamn right I needed to know. You should have told me this from the start. You're a selfish woman, Skeeter.
Stuart.
I think you're better off being alone.
Yeah, so, I mean, quite devastating that. For me, particularly in the end, you know? Mm-hmm. Shucks, I really had a lot more faith in him. Especially when he seemed to really... I mean, he read her columns and he wanted her to do something for herself. And he respected that about her. And then in the end... And you almost expect guys to be less petty about...
Did you find that petty?
I think you expect guys to care less about status in a strange way. I think you expect guys to care about material status, right? But I don't think you expect them to care about...
Although a woman can be part of their material status, so to speak.
Yeah, right? but I don't think... I expect guys to care less about ideological status in a very strange way. You know, I expect guys to just be mavericks and think and say and do what they want to as long as they have a really nice car and a nice house and a, you know, a fly chick. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like everything in between doesn't matter. So I didn't expect him to care that much about the book and how he felt almost sociopolitically compromised by it.
What I found so interesting and I wondered was, I mean, they were together for some time. Did he not hear what she talks about, what she thinks?
No, I mean, no, he must not have. I think she definitely kept a lot of that from him.
The thing is, she's such a vocal woman, you know, and that's the literally he said, I've never met a woman who says exactly what's on her mind. So surely she was, you know, like it sort of shows in the movie that she is that kind of person. So was he not exposed enough to her thinking to know or to even predict that she would probably be likely to do this kind of thing?
No. The thing is that like selective vision is so real. Selective hearing too. He dated her based on an idea.
They just think it was cute.
Based on an idea.
Look at how feisty you are.
Exactly. Based on an idea he had of her from the start. He told her, this is what I like. You know, he was like quite... Yeah, he was quite clear about the way that he saw her. And he probably just wanted to continue to see that in his kind of... I don't know, mild way.
Because I feel like that her kind of personality would have been annoyed with his kind of personality.
I don't know what happened there. I think it was. I think they both just really wanted it to work. I think they both just really wanted it to work, and they each compromised.
But see, this is the thing. I don't quite get the impression that Skeeta is that kind of girl. I don't,
yeah, but she,
you know
she
I mean?
Really fell for it. Like, she was gaga. I could see in the eyes. To be honest, there was like, it's just, you know, her defenses started to break down. Really. Her vigilance as well. It wasn't what it was in the start.
I must say, I found it a very inconsistent romance.
It's very strange.
I didn't understand
very,
it.
Very, very, very strange. it's also strange for a man to break up with you because you stand for something that is right.
Or different.
Or different.
Let's rather say different, because he might have just thought that it's different to the way he.
But he was traumatized, no?
He was.
Very traumatized, Shem.
I think he was crying.
Yeah, he was upset. He was definitely frazzled by it. Because I don't know if he. He just panicked. What was your favorite scene? Like your most victorious, most emotional scene?
To be honest, and I think. I think it's also just maybe got to do with my own like personal inclinations. I love the scenes where Aibileen is with the girl, the chubby girl, and says, "You is kind, you is smart, you is important."
That's so lovely.
This woman who has probably very little of what she actually wants in life. She's lost her own son. She's raised, 17 children that are not her own. And in spite of that, she can still offer more love and offer more love to the next child and to the next child and to the next child and still want the absolute best for them. She wants all of them to have a fighting chance.
It's really beautiful.
As much a fighting chance as if it was her own child. I also love that doesn't necessarily need to come from the person that's birthed you. You know, that thing can sometimes be offered by an unsuspecting person that you would never even imagine has the capacity to give that to you. I just find that as an idea beautiful.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the power in humanity. I actually think that societies screw shit up.
By like... forcing us to like love our mamas.
No, dude, I'm serious. I've gotten to a point in my life where I'm able to separate humanity and society, which I didn't think I'd, you know, for me, they were always synonymous, right? Like the people were the society and the society was the people. But I don't know. I'm not convinced anymore. I think society stifles humanity. Groupthink.
Yes, but I think.
Tribes.
But what we inherit is society made by people. You know, so we're still inheriting people.
But I think human beings, I love one-on-one human behavior.
Yeah.
Right? Because I think there's something very honest about it. I think the minute groups are interacting with groups, some shit goes down psychologically and people are different. It's like I always find people, which is why people can have, like, for instance, like put on a work hat or a professional hat and behave a certain way in that environment and then go home and be the softest people in the world, right? Like, the biggest assholes, CEOs that are the biggest assholes, can actually go home and be just the gentlest people in the world.
Yeah.
When they're with the people they love one-on-one. It's just, it's all too often people are different one-on-one. It's just it's sad. And I think...
And I mean, even as you say that, you know, like Aibileen and Minnie, you know, in the greater picture, in, you know, as a societal thing, they were trying to burn shit down.
Yeah, exactly.
But then again, in personal interactions with their white...
Yeah, they were so invested.
Madams, they were invested, yeah.
It's crazy. It's very crazy. True. Okay, well, no, so let's play some of those scenes then. Some of your favorite scenes.
Yeah.
You is kind. You is smart. You is important. You is smart. You is kind. You is important. Oh, that's so good. That's so good.
Oh man, I'm definitely gonna tell that to my kid.
Yeah,
one day.
Actually, I had a guy just like that. You is smart, exactly like that.
No, okay. Let me tell you what happened. Let me tell you what happened, girl. What happened was this past week. This past weekend, actually, a guy who may or may not like me sent me a text.
Aww.
And he was like, "You are smart. You are kind. You are important." I don't even know if he listened to the first part of the show or what happened. But I just melted.
That is so sweet.
I was just really beside myself.
I just feel like your child might have no idea why mommy's talking that
Doesn't
way.
Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. What do you want? You is smart. You is kind. You is important. What do you? No, I don't talk like that. Well, how would I say it? You are smart, you are kind, you are... No, friend, it doesn't have the same...
I know it doesn't. Uh-uh. It really doesn't.
Yay,
it was so...
Slim.
Oh, honey.
Yay, us. Kind. Yay, us. Belangra. No. No, okay.
No.
Okay.
No, but can't you do it in Xhosa?
Well, try it in French first.
Ooh. Tu es gentil, tu es intelligent.
Oh my god, obviously.
Tu es important.
Obviously French ones, obviously. Right? That's better than the English version.
I mean,
Damn this French.
I'm even loving myself a little bit more, you know what I'm saying?
Damn this French.
No, but how about yours? Yours is poetic language. Very beautiful.
Let me see if I can remember the words. Ulungile. Ubalile. Ubalekile.
Oh, I'd do that.
Oh my god, they all rhyme.
Yeah.
So it would be like,
I would do that.
Ulungile.
It even sounds like a song. Like,
Ulungile. Ubalile. Ubalekile.
Of course. Love that language.
Oh, I love yours. Love yours. Okay, so
what's your favorite?
My favorite was the scene. Oh my god, this whole scene is great on multiple levels. First of all, this man is just hot.
Who is?
Celia's husband. Celia the outlaw. Her husband. Yes. Her hubby is so sexy. And I particularly loved when he drives in as Minnie's walking in with the groceries.
Yeah.
And she's terrified. Like, she thinks this white man's about
to hurt somebody.
Shoot her point blank.
Yeah.
And so she starts running. She drops all her groceries, all her stuff. And she picks up the biggest branch I've ever seen anyone carry. She's going to hurt this guy. And then he's just so loving. He just flips the script on her completely and talks about how amazing she's been for his wife. And, you know, like how grateful he is and whatnot. And it was such a redeeming moment for the husbands, you know? It was such a humane moment. For all husbands of wives with domestic workers, all of them in history.
While at the same time, you know that he won't hold much influence with the other husbands because he's also as much an outcast as his wife.
It's true, but to see that he was capable of that means that the others are too, right? And I haven't felt that hopeful about men in this situation.
Yeah.
So that was really great. Mm-hmm. And then he's hot. And then,
in case you missed it,
God, there is something about a hot guy who's also kind. I'm sorry, I can't even deal.
Very true.
And then they walk into the house, and then he picks up that stuff for her, insists on carrying the groceries, puts his hand on her back, and ushers her into the house. And when she arrives there, there's Celia at this beautiful table with all this food that is prepared and this table that is set for Minnie. And she's done it all herself, and she's having simultaneously like a moment of pride and a moment of gratitude, you know? And Minnie in that moment as well is just so, she's uncomfortable because, she's surprised and uncomfortable because, you know, that would never happen. It's a bit of a mind, it's like a parallel universe for her. You know, she's about to be seated at this really fancy table with all this amazing food with her two employers. But she's also, you know, they've built such a friendship that it isn't too uncomfortable, you know? Mm. And kind of she sits down and relaxes and
she becomes less paranoid.
She becomes a lot less paranoid. Yeah. And then they serve her, which I thought was such a beautiful moment. Shucks, I could have died. And then the narrator says that table of food gave Minnie the strength she needed to take her and her babies out from under Leroy and never go back.
Mm.
And it was...
And if you remember, Leroy was very abusive.
Yes, was the abusive husband.
Mm.
But the fact that that gesture would give her that strength, it was so... It was so validating to her. It was such a moment where she realized her own worth. It's incredible. It's like, and we take these things for granted, you know? It's like the smile that you give somebody, the look that you give somebody, if you learn someone's name, any of those things, small things, sharing your sandwich with somebody, the ripple effects of those things can be actually quite profound. And the effect they have on people and their self-esteem, you know? You can literally, those things can, you know, I know it's well and good to do all these big things that change the world. But when people say it's that small stuff,
yeah,
it's real.
Although what I've come to realize is, you know, and I found it incredible that she did let her guard down and she did realize maybe these people are actually trustworthy. Maybe when they say I have a job for life, I really do. I still probably wouldn't trust them because I just, you know, just the fact that they are in that time in Mississippi, they are on the other side. It takes so much to choose to put aside the things that you have known to be true all along to now all of a sudden possibly accept these people as completely different to everything that you've been used to. And I mean, I find that struggle consistently in my life where I just don't trust people.
Well, I mean, I don't necessarily even think it's about trusting. It's just not... I don't trust
their actions, their gestures. You know what I mean?
You don't
it's that kind of stuff.
You don't have to trust them. You just have to take a leap of faith a little bit and meet them halfway, but sleep with one eye open. Mm. You know what I'm saying?
Mm. I'm sleeping with both open, girl.
You
know what I'm saying?
It's true. I have trust issues as well. Like, I don't immediately trust a white Afrikaans man. But I could still, like, I can still invest.
You can grow into.
I can lean into the interaction and I can invest and I can leap with one eye open. And I really, that's the most important thing, is the willingness to be proven wrong.
I guess the moment I see little habits that are so reminiscent of everything that I'm used to, I'm like, you see, therefore.
But that's where that compartmentalization comes in.
Yeah.
Like, you've got to accept people for their good and their bad qualities. And, like, I used to be really, really precious that way. Like, I used to throw the baby out with the bathwater every single time. I just needed people
to leave. I'm there.
Take everything.
I'm there.
Take all of it.
Pretend you done never met me before.
And just
go.
Cut. You know what I mean? I literally, gosh, I used to be so unforgiving about people's, especially people who held different ideas to me, beliefs, you know, things.
Again, but how long did that take you? Because if it was maybe that, I don't know, in a few scenarios you realize, okay, maybe you guys just aren't gelling, versus maybe spending 3, 4, 5 years, 10 years busy, like, you know, trying to, I don't know, give them a chance or trying to understand their point of view, etc., etc., and you realize it's actually falling on deaf ears. Like, doesn't it also depend on time?
Both ways I can see how it works. I mean, in the long relationship, the reason that you want to try becomes more sentimental, right? You're more likely just to have outgrown each other completely as humans. But I still find with new people that I meet, I actually invite, especially just doing the show and everything, I invite people who I don't understand. and who disagree with me a lot more than I used to, because I'm actually invested in my own. It's very selfish, but like, you know, it's also an investment in my own personal development and in expanding my own thinking and my own perspective. But it's definitely not easy. And
actually, it would be really nice to hear from you guys, the listeners, if any of you suffer from severe trust issues.
We always talk about the power of the domestic worker, and I think there's a scene in here particularly that speaks to that, and it involves shit. But it's just like, think about who you're alienating. You know, when you when we mistreat people close to us, oftentimes we don't think about the role they play in our lives. And this is the mistake that our dear Haley made with Minnie. I don't know if you want to explain the scene further.
Just disclaimer, please don't imagine that your domestic worker has done this to you.
No, of course not. No. Look. But also just think. Just let it be a lesson to anyone.
It could happen from anywhere. Anything.
You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying?
Very true. Very true.
Okay, so here it is.
Oh, the lovely Minnie, who just really got hard done by. And, you know, because she used the toilet on the inside of the house rather than the outside of the house. And Hilly was really angry and just fired her on the spot. So she went back to Hilly's house and she makes really, really nice pies. And as a token of her
defiance.
Okay, let's call it that. She comes back with a pie that she actually made.
She shat in it.
Out of her shit.
She shat in it.
Can you just?
She defecated in the pie.
Can you just?
And the beauty is it takes... Hilly has two slices of this pie.
So she gets called Two Slice Hilly.
And she doesn't taste it because it actually is that good.
Yeah.
Right? I didn't know food could be that good that it disguised shit, but apparently it does. The funny thing here is how her own mother turns on her, and actually we hear later on as well why she did it. And
yes. Take a listen.
Nobody wanted to hire a sass-mouthing, thieving Negro. Did they?
Oh, pie's as good as always, Minnie.
I'm glad you like it.
Oh.
If I take you back, I'll have to cut your pay $5 a week.
Take me back?
What do you put in here that makes it taste so good?
That good vanilla from Mexico. And something else real special. No, Miss Walters. That's Miss Hilly's special pie.
Mama can have a piece.
Oh, let her one.
Go get a plate.
Eat my shit.
What'd you say?
I said, eat my shit.
Have you lost your mind?
No, ma'am. But you about to. Because you just did.
Did what?
Yeah, so that was deep. But definitely hysterical. And she literally she got a bump on her mouth.
Ugh.
From eating it.
Yeah, it looked disgusting.
Like a shit bump. I didn't know that was a thing. But so there's this, the one of the most powerful moments for me. And really just, just testament to what can happen when somebody really comes into their power and they start to believe in themselves, how their whole demeanor changes, right? And we've spoken about how, you know, uniform, for instance, something like uniform can like change somebody's whole demeanor. And I think this is what happened through this process with Skeet, and this is what we hope to achieve through the mate sessions as well. So there's this unbelievable moment where Aberline walks into the house and there is Hilly with Elizabeth, her friend, and she's trying to get Aberline fired for stealing. She's just made up a story about her stealing cutlery or something. And she's trying to get her fired, and Aberline gets so fed up. You know, initially she's like very polite, you know, and like respectful as she would be as the help, but she just gets to a point where she realizes what she's just done in writing this book, and she steps fully into that character, you know, that newfound character, and she gives her some serious sass. And I love the scene. Check it out.
Aberline, can you come in here, please?
Good morning.
Aberline, the silver I lent Elizabeth last week.
And I polish good? Humidity had been fighting me on polishing day.
When you returned it, three pieces were missing from the felt wrapper. A fork and two spoons.
Let me go check in the kitchen. Maybe I left some behind.
You know as well as I do, that silver's not in the kitchen.
You checking May Mobley's bed? Since little man was born, she's been putting things in it.
Do you hear her, Elizabeth? She's trying to blame it on a toddler.
I ain't got no silver.
She says she doesn't have them. Then it behooves me to inform you that you are fired, Aberline. And I'll be calling the police.
Maybe my fault.
I'll go get some syrup, Miss Leaf.
Elizabeth can take care of her own children.
I'll go get the cough syrup.
Come here, little man.
I'm okay.
Mine's still no silver.
Maybe I can't send you to jail for what you wrote, but I can send you for being a thief.
I know something about you. Don't you forget that. But what you and May says is a lot of time to write letters in jail. Plenty of time to write the truth about you. And the paper's free.
Nobody would believe what you wrote.
I don't know. I've been told I'm a pretty good writer. Already sold a lot of books.
Call the police, Elizabeth.
All you do is scare and lie to try to get what you want.
Aberline, stop.
You a godless woman. Ain't you tired, Miss Hilly?
You know, like, I literally clapped. It was just me.
Did you slow clap?
No, I didn't slow clap.
Okay.
Because I was a bit ashamed. I was just trying to get it over with, but I had to do it because I was in the room by myself. I clapped. It's such a great moment, and I hope that we eventually get there.
But you know, that is a wish for probably everyone. You know, that feeling, I think, is a feeling that everyone deserves.
Absolutely. And, yeah. There's, after that scene, she kind of walks out and she leaves the job, and I think she says it's her or the narrator. Maybe she is the narrator. She might be the narrator, actually, come to think of it.
And has she been the narrator the whole time?
I know, right? I'm only realizing that now. But she ends with the following words. She says, "No one had ever asked me what it felt like to be me. But once I told the truth about that, I felt free." I thought, shucks. It's such a simple action to ask somebody how it feels like to be them, but it can have such a powerful effect on them.
Absolutely.
So yeah, that probably captures in general what I got out of the movie.
Yeah. I'm gonna add just one more thing in there. But just the one scene where Skeeter's mom says sometimes courage skips a generation.
Ooh, that's also really pretty.
Yeah. It's very interesting also because in the time that we're in, where so many of us believe that the born freeze didn't care for democracy.
Yeah.
You know, they were free, or they are free. So, you know, would they even care? And also, like, the criticisms with, you know, social media and all that kind of stuff, and how they're just really plugged in. They don't care much for reality. And how, in a way, courage skipped our generation, you know, like... Yeah. In our age group, and they're the ones who are now younger that are taking on the democratic fight.
Beautiful.
Very, very nice.
Beautiful.
And yeah, I think every generation's always got something to learn from another.
Mm-hmm. But well said. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah.
On the meditations with cliffcentral.com. Be sure to follow us on where?
On Twitter at Made Project, MAIDE Project, as well as Facebook. You can just type in the Made Session.
I'm sorry, guys, I don't have social media brain. Like, I can't get the stuff straight.
I tried to get off social media and it lasted about 3 minutes.
Cox! Anyway, yes, take care and remember, you is kind.
You is smart.
You is important. Bye.
Bye.
Cliff Central.
The revolution.
I've got something important to tell you.
CliffCentral.com.
CliffCentral.com.